This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on January 12, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The open session for Thursday, January 12th will now come to order.
Happy New Year, everybody. It's good to see you all back. This is my first meeting as chair. My name is Caroline Hunter, and I'm the last person in the rotation of the current crop of commissioners to serve as chair. So all the rest of us have already served as chair, right? Haven't you?
Well, not in this rotation.
Oh, well, of the people sitting up here, how's that?
Once a chair, always a chair?
Something like that. But anyway, I'm the last one, so I guess that's good for me. I have the benefit of good advice and counsel from all five of you, and I look forward to that throughout the year. Look forward to working with the staff, and it'll be an exciting year, as is evidenced by the fact that we did a quick Westlaw search this morning, and the FEC has already been mentioned approximately 175 times in news accounts since the first of the year. And we currently have 7 pending advisory opinion requests, one of which we'll talk about today. Probably 4 of them we'll do next week and then in the coming weeks. So it's a great beginning to the year, and I look forward to it. Vice Chair, do we have a late submitted document?
Do you want to start with the motion?
Let's start with the, approval of minutes. That's a good
idea.
Let's
approve the minutes. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of the minutes for December 15th, 2011, as set forth in agenda document number 1202.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And the first motion of the year passes unanimously.
Unanimously.
Do we have a late submitted document, Madam Vice Chair?
I believe we do, Madam Chair. Therefore, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so we may consider agenda document number 12-01 and 12-01A.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes.
Unanimously.
Unanimously.
What are the editorial
points? I don't know. That's 2 in a row, even. Excellent. The next item on our agenda is draft advisory opinion 12-01, 12-01A, Louder Solutions, LLC, doing business as StandLouder.com. And this morning we have Mr. Jim Call, who's the counsel, and Mr. Victor Hanick, who's the manager and owner of Louder Solutions, LLC, here with us today. Would you like to join us? Thank you. And we have a presentation this morning by Mr. Theodore Lutz of the Office of General Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. You have for consideration agenda documents 12-01 and 12-01A. These documents contain 3 draft responses to an advisory opinion request by Louder Solutions, LLC, doing business at StandLouder.com. StandLouder.com asks 4 questions. First, whether it is a political committee. Second, whether it, content creators, and funders will become a political committee or series of political committees. Third, what disclaimer and disclosure obligations apply. And fourth, whether as an alternative, it may form an independent expenditure-only committee. The drafts agree that StandLouder.com will not become a political committee and that StandLouder.com may form an independent expenditure-only committee. The drafts differ, however, as to what disclaimer and disclosure obligations apply in the circumstances under which StandLouder.com and its users may become a political committee. The Commission received 1 comment on the drafts. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions for the counsel or Mr. Hanick? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start. I have no questions for counsel, but I do have some questions for Mr. Call and Mr. Hanick, and thank you for coming. Welcome back, Mr. Call. Always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here, Madam Vice Chairman.
I hope you're still saying that at the end of the day.
I'm sure I will be.
Mostly, I'm trying to get some more information about how this is all going to work, because I think I'm still a little bit fuzzy on the details. Now, you're proposing to do this as a profit-making enterprise?
That is correct.
And how are the profits going to be generated?
Primarily, we offer a service, and we charge a service fee for contributions towards particular campaigns, particular editorials, and we take a percentage of that as our service charge for the service that we're offering. And what we're doing is facilitating the aggregation of funds in order to support this particular campaign, and we're also doing the media buying. We have the media buying expertise to actually place these ads into broadcast.
You have a background in media buying?
I personally do not. We have a media buying company that's doing that for us.
Okay. And are you going to charge placement fees when you place these ads?
Can you expand placement fees to who?
Well, normally when a media buyer, you know, I take it what people are going to do is they're going to post something on your website, and then ultimately, if there's enough interest generated, you're going to then place it as a broadcast ad. Is that
correct?
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, at that point, normally media vendors charge something
right.
for that.
The media
service.
Vendor does have a placement fee that we will pay them, and that will also come out of the contributions towards that campaign or that ad.
And, but is that part of the initial fee that you charge people to use your service, or do you then charge an extra fee if you place the ad?
There are two separate fees. There's a fee for the creators on the way in the door. It's sort of a nominal service charge, $25 or less. The objective there is these are people who are serious about this. They're putting some stake in the game. So it's a $25 fee for the ad to come in, and it covers Mr. Hanek's costs of processing, get the ad up on the website, changes that may need to be made to the ad if, for example, disclaimers are required. So there's a $25 fee in. And then there's out the door, once the ads are placed, that there is a part of profit that's made on the placement of the ads on radio or TV.
And that
TV initially is where he's starting off.
And I would like to clarify that it's going to be a transparent process that individuals, it will be very clear on the website, when an individual makes a contribution towards a particular ad, they will know exactly what percentage of their money is ultimately going towards the placement of that ad and what percentage of that money goes towards the service charges that we have for facilitating this process.
Yeah, all of this will be described in as is normally the case on any website in the terms of service so that when they click, the folks who want to participate become users. When they click, they will understand what the terms are and how fees are generated.
You mean that long list of fine print that nobody ever reads before they click?
We're going to make it a larger font.
Just wondering. So the model is that when you're assessing whether there's enough interest, enough pledges to place an ad, you factor in the cost of buying the time and whatever venue you choose, as well as this profit margin. Is that
well? So. Clearly, at each stage, there's cost to us in terms of moving that ad into the next stage. We have to do our legal clearance, and we have to make sure that this ad is going to be acceptable to the broadcast networks, and we have to come up with an advertising strategy for that ad. So we have these required costs up front, and so we have mechanisms in place to determine the interest level in a particular ad so that we know when we're investing this that there will be enough people that have pledged this particular ad that it will actually generate enough sponsorship to offset those costs for us. And then at that point, it opens up, and anybody can come in and just contribute whatever they like to contribute towards the promotion of that particular advertisement.
And just to clarify, when Mr. Hanek was talking about the legal clearance, there's the things you'd have to do to put anything up there, copyright infringement, pornography. I mean, there are clearances that we need to make sure that this is something that can actually be put up on TV and won't violate any laws.
I appreciate the clarification, but now I've forgotten. There's something that Mr. Hannock said that was going to trigger another question for me, and now I've forgotten what it was. So when you say that people are then, I guess I'm still confused about how this works. So people sign up with these pledges. They say, I would be interested in pledging X number of dollars towards placing this ad somewhere. And then once there's enough money in the pot to actually place the ad.
Well, so once we've ascertained that there are enough pledges and we feel that this particular ad will generate enough interest. I don't think the pledges themselves will generate the appropriate funds in order to broadcast that ad. That's just our mechanism that we use to determine the interest level, because a pledge has a cost of a dollar, a nominal cost of a dollar, so that we require a credit card so that we can verify that it's a legitimate interest in supporting this ad. And at the time of the pledge, they indicate how much they would sponsor the ad for. At the time that we determine that there is enough interest and that this particular ad is likely to generate additional revenues, additional funding, then at that point we put it into our top tier, our primetime category, and then it's open for funding. And all the people that pledged it, they get notified, and they have an opportunity to come back and fulfill their original pledged amount. And then at that point, it's open to anybody else. Once the advertisements start running, people see the advertisement, they may say, I agree with this particular advertisement. I want more people to see it. So they come to the website, and they have the opportunity to provide additional funding towards that ad.
So the additional funding would go towards running the ad longer.
That's right.
But you would
on a broader scale, running it longer, et cetera.
And what happens if you get some extra money but not enough to, you know, buy the next increment of time or buy it in the next market or something?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that we can spend that money. But ultimately, our goal is every last dollar will be spent in the interest of the people making those purchases on advertising, and we're going to use that to the best of our ability.
Okay, I'm confused now. What does that mean? If it's not going toward...
Well, ultimately, there's opportunities in local networks, et cetera, where you can really have lower cost purchases for airtime. And so we're going to use every last dollar in purchasing airtime for that particular advertisement.
And if it doesn't work out to a perfect round number that exactly equals the number of pledges,
then we would be happy as a company to balance that out.
Madam Vice Chair, there's a provision in there that if, for example, whether you're at the first stage, somebody's pledged a dollar, mm-hmm. you know, they've made a pledge, but he's only going to deduct a dollar, if there are a lot of single dollar contributions hanging around and the ad's just going nowhere.
Right.
You got to figure out what do we do with those dollars. Or if it's later on, he's done a run and there's somebody's got $50 sitting in an account. Then they have a default option there. They can take the person who's initially donated the funds. Those funds can then be redirected towards another ad that they might be interested in supporting. Or if the funds merely sit for over a year and they're not redirected, then they're given to charities that are listed, will be listed on the website. Our concern here is we had to deal with something that I honestly hadn't thought about since law school, and that was state escheat laws, which we needed to find a way to deal with that. And the way to deal with that is to provide as a default it would go to charities if it's just sitting in an account.
See what happens when you go back into the private sector, Mr. Call? You have to deal with all sorts of
things you learn.
Now, this initial dollar, is this does that go towards a later ad buy, or is that profit for you, or, you know, sort of a sign of good faith that somebody's willing to actually put up some money?
It is really a sign of good faith that someone is actually willing to put up that money. Unlike a a thumbs up, which anybody can click, and there's an opportunity for fraud with automated programs, that kind of thing. When we charge a dollar, we're not really making any money off of that dollar with the credit card processing fees, but it requires them to put in a credit card, and we can verify the authenticity of that pledge and that it's a legitimate interest in supporting that particular advertisement.
And that dollar ultimately, if the ad gets placed, will go towards placing the ad?
Yes, ultimately that dollar goes towards placing the ad.
Okay. And I gather that you're prepared to do a little bit of rounding up if you get close to the amount of money that you would need to place the ad. Stan Louder's going to kick in something. Is that?
Well, I think that Stan Louder will automatically kick in a minimum when they make this decision to make sure that the ad runs to some extent. But past that, it's just going to be user contributions.
So is it possible that Stan Louder won't kick in any money when an ad runs?
Yes.
What we had represented in the advisory opinion request was that there might be instances where Stan Louder would be making putting funds in towards the airing of an ad, but we would come up with objective criteria for that and apply it evenly to anybody in a similar situation, so that if a certain level of funds were raised, regardless of the nature of the ad, who submitted it, it would be similar treatment for those conditions under which Stan Louder would make that, so he's not making it just on one side of the aisle,
right,
or the other.
And you've said that you're not... You're going to run ads on both sides. You could be running ads on behalf of candidates who are running against each other. You're not doing this on an ideological basis.
Absolutely not. I am absolutely not doing it on an ideological basis. The intent with all of our objective criteria is that we're not taking one side or the other. It's ultimately up to the internet community to decide which ads are worthy of additional broadcast. And we play no role other than to ensure that we will not be sued as a result of playing a particular ad. So we have objective legal and technical criteria for the submissions. But past that, we don't impose our decisions in one way or the other. It's ultimately an objective criteria as we move campaigns, ads from tier to tier, and the broadcasting is decided by the user community that decides to fund those particular ads.
Now, you've said, though, that you will require the creators to give you the rights and that you might change the ads.
That would only be in the circumstance of if the broadcast network has an issue with a technical quality of the advertisement, then we reserve the right to change the ad to correct that issue. But we're not going to be making any material changes to the ad other than obviously adding disclaimers at the end of the ad, that kind of thing.
So you're not going to be making substantive changes to
the
content.
We will not make substantive. That would be unfair to individuals that pledged one version of it, and then we come in and make substantive changes, then they're no longer getting what they paid for. So it would be inappropriate for us to do so.
Just so that's clear, there may be changes that have to be made from the posting on the website to the movement to TV because time, space, and technical issues.
Okay. So... if you're not ideological and you're not creating the ads and you're just taking what you get and in some cases, and probably from your perspective, you're hoping that it'll be in most cases, you're not going to kick in any of your own funds for it. In what sense will it be accurate to say in your disclaimer, paid for by Stan Louder? And how will that provide useful information to the public about who's really supporting this ad?
Well, there are instances in which Stan Louder, in fact, will be providing some financial support, albeit on a nonpartisan basis and based upon objective criteria. So in the sense of paid, they may, in fact, be paying for part of it. And as we...
But they may not.
And, you know, what we recognized in putting this together is that this... this model, this funding model, fundamentally does not fit neatly within the Commission's regulations on disclosures and disclaimers. We know that. So what we tried to do in our request was to find what was the most logical model for people and entities that are doing the same kinds of things, and that's why we had argued for treatment similar to advocacy groups or trade associations who, after all, also collect funds from lots of entities, members, individuals. They collect them, they run the ad, and they put their name on it.
But at least in that case, if I can interrupt you, Mr. Collin, at least in that case, they are promoting a, you know, if the ad says paid for by the Chamber of Commerce or the Sierra Club or the National Rifle Association or any number of trade associations or advocacy groups we could come up with, at least people have some sense of who those groups are. And, you know, putting aside the question of whether it might be better to have even more detailed disclosure of who's particularly funding those ads, people know what the Chamber is. They know what the Sierra Club is. They know what the NRA is. Stand Louder is just, it has no ideal, as you just said, it has no ideological agenda. It has no persona out there that people can figure out, well, who's really behind this ad?
Well, but that's the disclosure end of it. That's why he is undertaking the obligation that he will file either the IE or the EC reports. He will gather that information, which is logical since he's the central point where the information will be coming in. He'll file the reports and indicate all the individuals, when required by FEC rules, who have made donations to support the ad. So if somebody is trying to find information about who's behind this, they can go to one place, find the disclosures that the reports that Stand Louder has filed, and see the individuals who have made donations to it, as opposed to an alternative approach, which would be for individuals to do it on their own. And so, how do you find that? You know, you're looking through,
and they probably mess it up. And that's one of the most appealing features of this to me is that you're trying to. And I give you credit for this. You're trying to take responsibility for making sure that the reports get filed properly, and I appreciate that. I'm just, my concern is whether this information is going to be ultimately, you know, useful to the public. And you know, it sounds like you've got a plan to try and address the disclosure end of it, but the disclaimer end is still going to be, if anything, even less informative than paid for by Americans for Apple Pie. Got anything for me?
Well, it's certainly as useful as that, and you know, you can actually go to the website and find out what StandLouder.com is, and he will, and Victor will go out of his way to explain exactly what StandLouder.com is, because he certainly hopes that everybody in America knows what it is and goes there. So it's very easy for the public to find out what it is, but again, it's not a neat fit with the regulations. StandLouder.com is certainly an active participant in the generation and getting the ad up. So we thought the most logical analogy is exactly what advocacy groups and associations are doing.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's the most direct analogy or whether it's more like a media vendor. You know, the media vendor who places the ad and it never says paid for by the media vendor. It says paid for by the guy that hired the media vendor. But I'm struggling with the same problem that you faced when you posed your request. I'm trying to figure out which box to put you guys in, because unfortunately our regulations kind of require that we find a box for you.
Well, you know, in the second question that's in there is whether to establish StandLouder.com as a political committee, and if treated as a political committee is normally treated, you wouldn't get any more information. In fact, you'd get less, but you wouldn't get any more.
If can other political committees make pledges to fund your ads?
Yes. Non-connected and SSFs can contribute.
So is there a risk that somebody else who wanted to avoid filing a an independent expenditure report or an EC report where they might be required to list their donors might try and get around that requirement by instead going through you, and then the IE or EC report that you would file would merely disclose the entity rather than the individual donors.
I don't know if they would do that. If whoever makes a contribution would be reported in the appropriate EC and IE report as required.
Just wondering if you had a fix for me on that one.
That might be a bigger picture fix.
Yeah. Let me go back to how this is going to work in terms of placing the ads. As you've pointed out, you know, there's local markets, which are a lot less expensive, and then there's national markets, which regional markets that are going to be a lot more expensive. So how do you decide, let's say you've got enough pledges that it looks like you could place it in some little town somewhere. How are you going to make those decisions about when and whether to place the ads?
Well, basically, we're going to use advertising consultants to help us make that decision, along with our media buying company, to see where we can place that ad to have the most impact on behalf of the individuals contributing to that particular ad. And we're going to make that, we're going to post that strategy in broad terms on the website so that individuals contributing know what our advertising strategy is and what they will be funding.
So you're going to have, you've got media consultants and these advertising folks who are going to be looking at all the markets. You've got your legal fees. I mean, it sounds like it could be a pretty expensive operation to be...
Hence the service charge.
Well, I mean, it sounds like it could be a pretty expensive operation to fund off of $25 service charges. And of course, that assumes that people will... That assumes that people will think that this is a better venue for posting stuff than, say, putting it up on YouTube.
So just to be clear, the $25 service charge is a charge we charge for people submitting.
Right.
When people sponsor particular advertisements and they're contributing X amount of dollars, our service charge is a percentage of that contribution. And so the larger the contributions are, the more money we get in order to support our efforts towards broadcasting that particular ad.
And that percentage is, I assume, comparable to what other analogous vendors would be charging?
It's similar to the Ticketmaster model, right? Is you purchase a ticket and they charge a service charge for that based on the price of that ticket.
Okay. I'm just trying to get my mind around the entire picture here. You're being innovative. That's a good thing. But as I said, I'm trying to figure out which box to put it in our regulations. So I appreciate your indulging all of my questions. I don't have anything else right now, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in. I have some questions as well, and I appreciate your willingness to come and talk to us. This is a really innovative idea, and I think I was reading your press release this morning about sort of your motivation behind this, and I think providing this idea of a megaphone to sort of normal people is a really interesting idea and certainly to be welcomed. But again, we have to try to figure out where this all fits. I have some questions about the license. So Creator puts an ad on your site, and as a part of that agreement that they click through, I assume it says that you'll be getting a license. Can you describe in more detail for me, is it a limited license, is it an exclusive license? What is the nature of that? Could I, as a creator, put an ad on your site and then also go put it on, there are other sites who do not quite the same model, but similar types of things work. Could I use it as in somewhere else as well, or are you getting an exclusive license?
Yeah, so the answer to that is we're trying to figure that out too.
It would be at least a limited use license. We are honestly trying to figure out the business pros and cons of being exclusive. It may be that would greatly impede inflow if it's an exclusive people are giving up rights to their creations. Mm-hmm. So, but it is at least a limited right to use, modify as necessary for technical requirements so that he is fully within his rights in distributing and.
But that would mean the copyright would retain with the original, with the creator, and you would have a license to use the work. And
that is a possibility.
In that scenario.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Because that plays into, frankly, I'm perhaps like my colleague, Commissioner Weintraub, sort of torn between the approaches in draft B and C. In draft B, you, as Stan Lauder, become the speaker, which would make perhaps a little more sense to me if you own the work outright, as if it were an exclusive license from the creator, because then it would be your thing and your speech. And this comes up, I think, because we haven't really had a scenario where someone standing in the place of like a vendor, a media vendor, acquires the speech as their own and makes this and is the maker of the speech, and there's some questions that maybe we can't even answer today about that, because if Stan Lauder is the speaker, and over the course of the next election year, all of the editorials that you've called them become placed, and let's say that they are all turn out to be independent expenditures. That's what the user community decides they want to do. Let's say they all support one political party across the United States. These are things outside of your control, as I understand it. You won't be engaging in any editorial control on right. this sort of thing. At that point, you as the speaker have now engaged in 100% of your activities off of the internet in independent expenditure. At that point, do you have a major purpose of influencing a federal election? Is that something that can change over time? One of your questions is, are we a political committee? And you tell us that you have a profit-based motive, so that your major purpose at this moment in time is not to influence the federal election. But if all of this speech is Stan Lauder's under your scenario, at some point, do you become a political committee, or at least do you have the purpose of influencing the election?
Well, two things on that, and let me start with the political committee. The purpose of Stan Lauder is not limited to ads that deal with federal candidates and office holders. People can submit ads about anything. It can be about an issue. It can be about their kid's baseball team. It can be about a charitable. It could be about anything. You know, if a community finds this an effective way to get news out about the, you know, the church fundraiser, God bless them. You know, it's. So when you look at the entirety of the activities of StandLouder.com, we honestly anticipate that a limited amount is going to be dealing with candidates and have express advocacy or constitute electioneering communication. So looked at as a whole, we don't think we could come close to the major purpose test. If analyzing ad by ad, whether each one is a political committee, I don't think the commission has ever taken that approach.
I wasn't actually addressing that part of it. I wanted, because as you pointed out, this is what actually goes on from your website to onto television is not within your control. And while I understand that you want to be a platform for all different types of activities, political and otherwise, it might turn out to be that this is a forum that is particularly interesting to those who want to participate in federal races, and I'm just trying to figure out that if we say yes to you today, or maybe next week, I think we have some. We say yes to you, and then a year from now, it turns out that this platform has been particularly interesting and used by people who want to make IEs, and that turns out to be the only types of things that reach the funding level that makes sense for you to be take the next step and put them in your primetime area, as I think you've described it.
I think maybe part of the answer is this. Yes, for the very wealthy individuals or well-funded association, they're able to go out and hire these people to do these things, and maybe in a sense it becomes solely their advocacy. That's not what StandLouder.com was created to do, was to try to provide a venue for folks who don't have this kind of money. It's for the smaller individuals who would like to, have their support, their issues being promoted, and who don't have the funding. So they're hiring StandLouder.com, who can go out and do these things with the aggregated funds. So they're going to have, hire the consultants that he's going to have to find the best placement to do the media buying. It stands it on its head somewhat, but I don't know if that addresses the issue in its entirety, but it's the only effective way this can work.
And let me be clear, I'm entirely sympathetic with the concern that you have, that seems to motivate, as I understand your model, and appreciate the idea of providing more opportunities for people to, in whatever means they have, to be able to participate in this process. So that's not the question. Yeah. It's just a matter of, it seems to me that your alternative you propose, of course, of creating a committee makes all of this, does fit into one of our known boxes. And so if we're trying to figure out what works outside of there, these are some of the questions that I think are raised by the fact that you don't have control. You're operating as a business entity. I understand that. You don't want to take positions or advocate for particular candidates or issues. But that then leaves you in the position of having other people decide what is your speech, because you're in your request, you're telling us that this is going to be your speech. And so along with that, in our usual way of thinking about how the government interacts with people's speeches, it is yours. And so therefore that has some consequences too.
It's all of those services that are being provided which led us to the conclusion, this really is a vendor. It's not a political committee because of the nature of what's being done, the services that are being provided, and it's open to all, which is how we saw that falling into that category much more closely.
Right. And I think that's and I understood that that's what you were trying to be. I take you at your word that you're interested in being, as nonpartisan and as multi issue and activity as possible. But then if you're a vendor, then as Commissioner Weintraub pointed out, when I place an ad through a media buyer, the media buyer doesn't show up on the disclaimer. And that's the tension that we're trying to get through here. I have a question. In your comment, and I appreciated your comment, you noted that with respect to question four, that you would be reporting the contribution, you were reporting as a contribution the content that you receive from the creator. And I'm wondering, outside of question four, if on a particular IE report, would you be reporting the creator as a contributor to that IE as well?
It depends. If the individual qualifies for the individual internet, uncompensated activity on the internet, then that doesn't count as a contribution, and we wouldn't. If it was a corporation, for example, that submitted the creation, and then that would count as a contribution, and it would be reported.
Are you going to be asking content providers about their creation process? Because, of course, because they put it up on your website, you don't know how. Okay.
Specifically, we'll be asking about the cost of creation.
Okay.
If they've checked the box, they're an individual, and that they're uncompensated for their activities on the Internet, then those costs would not be reportable. If it was a corporation or a political committee, for example, then those costs would be reportable because they would be a contribution.
But if I'm an individual and just because I'm uncompensated for my internet activities might not mean that I didn't pay somebody to hold the camera while I filmed, whatever, and then I took that digital. And so I assume there still could be costs.
That's why it's a maybe is the answer.
Okay. I appreciate in your comment the clarification that Stan Lauder won't be participating in these online message boards. I think that is a lingering question about at what point do a group of individuals who are collaborating together in some fashion obviously become a political committee. And we've attempted to address this in other advisory opinions with not much success, because this is a challenging area. But it does seem to me that a group, if, for example, you could see a pattern emerging over time of this group of people who are engaging in this online discussion forum for this ad, and it seems to me that at some point there could be enough activity there that they might become a political committee. And I just wanted to, you tell us that Stan Lauder won't be participating in these online message boards, but there will come a time if an ad becomes popular enough that it makes your prime time list and you're going to do this vetting, and then you might be making some modifications to the ad. Is there any, what kind of communication will Stan Lauder have with the creator in points in time where you, if any, if that you might need to change the ad, or if you have concerns about questions about, like, copyright, you might have to go back to someone and find out where they got a particular image if you have those sorts
sure,
of
things. Sure, we'd have to contact them to get that information, but once they've handed that ad off to us, we then take ownership of that, and we create the advertising strategy. We tell people what that is, and so it would be inappropriate for us after the fact, based on some communication that happened in the message board, to change the content of the ad, to change the advertising strategy, because that message board doesn't represent everybody that has contributed to that ad, and we want to fulfill the service for everybody that contributes to that ad, as we stated up front. I mean, that's one of our value propositions, is that when a customer comes to our website, they can pick a particular ad, and they know exactly what it is that they're contributing to. They're not contributing to some pack where they don't have control over how those funds ultimately get used. They are picking that particular ad, and that is the ad that will ultimately get played broadcast nationally.
Do the message boards, are they attached to particular ads?
They are.
And do they exist in that earlier stage of when you can pledge?
They exist in all stages.
Okay. All right, thank you.
So once it's in the beginning stage, you know, when people can pledge, and when they're open for sponsorship, anybody can communicate. It's an issue, and
sure,
people want to talk about that issue. That's a forum for them to do so.
And I sometimes read comments to news articles just for fun, because
same
they're
concept.
Very entertaining. Some of them have nothing to do with what might be above it, but that's not a question for the FEC.
And from the business perspective, that's just a method for us to keep individuals engaged, and possibly to have people that decide that they don't agree with someone else's point of view, and therefore they're going to sponsor an opposing campaign, for example. So.
Those are all the questions I have for now. Thank you very much.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Many of the questions have already been asked are the same questions I had. This is not an easy one for a couple different reasons, but simply because it's not an easy one doesn't mean it's not a good idea. It's an interesting model. Unfortunately, how the world works is you have to navigate the government to get this going, and I would say I appreciate you coming in to check first, but on the other hand, some of this seems like cart before the horse, because some of, you know, you may evolve a different way, you may find things change, and it's tough to lock in AO. My point is I'd hate to have an AO lock you in to one way and not be able to sort of, you know, grow. And so I'm telling you, go forth and grow. because it is sort of the next wave. You had you know, TV, where you, even if you're a campaign, you hire a consultant, puts the ad together, you watch it, thumbs up, thumbs down, you get a media buyer, outside groups pop up. Here you're going much more direct from the contributor to the actual spending. It's something that that some of us talked about years ago, that at some point this would happen. I thought of it more in terms of legal terms. The idea of contribution limits on independent political committees didn't make a lot of sense because I saw that more as a spending limit. So now it's actually caught up with where I was legally, that now you actually do have people putting money directly behind a specific ad and putting it up on TV. And you're letting people who otherwise couldn't afford to put up their own splashy ad find other people they don't even know and they've never talked to, pool money, and put it up. And I think that's great. The trick is, how do we stay out of the way as much as possible, but yet not ignore what's in the statute? What's tough about the statute is when it was passed, Congress actually limited expenditures even if done independent. That was struck by the Supreme Court. Not only do you have unlimited independent expenditures now, they have unlimited money coming into groups they do, which is another new one. So the statute itself did not contemplate any of this, let alone the internet and the ability to move. So this is kind of awkward all around, and you know, it's tough. But you do have, if you're doing an IE, there is a disclosure obligation for an IE and all that kind of thing, and we're here trying to figure that out. So I think I picked up on something that Commissioner Bowerly said in sort of fleeting reference to whose speech is it? And this is a gist, I think, of some of the vice chair's questions. You know, is it really paid for by Stan Lauder, or is it paid for by somebody else? And I think we ask the same questions and we have different concerns as to where this could go. You're not a traditional media buyer, as I understand it. Traditional media buyer, you hire them, they'll give you the inventory that's available, they may actually recommend where they're going to, where you ought to place, but ultimately the client makes a decision where to place. They want broadcast, or they want cable, they want news adjacent, or they don't. There's that whole, you know, media buying world that ultimately they decide. In your case, as you understand it, Stan Lauder makes that decision, so you're much more part of the creative in that way. I don't think media buying is part of the creative to a certain extent, but it is actually part of the coordination rules here. If you place media, that's enough to perhaps taint something. It's nothing really to do with you guys for what we're doing here today, but for whatever, I don't agree with that part of the coordination rule. I think media buying is much more of a vendor, not a creative person. But there is a school of thought that it is part of the creative. And you are doing the buy, which makes you... And you're making the ultimate decision, which for me distinguishes you from, say, the BlackRock situation we had a while ago and other situations, which is more my concern and my questions, is that we don't hear undo other things that some of us have already carved out. When you place, you have a separate media buyer that places the buy, and I assume they're going to be paid on a percentage because that's how media buyers get paid.
That's correct.
The money that they get into their account, the place to buy, comes from Stan Lauder, right? Let's assume for some reason the media buyers owed money, right? When you buy media, if you're using the same media buyer, they tend to do a lot of buying. You know, there may be cashbacks that come from the stations. It's a very complicated accounting process that happens on the tail end. And let's say they're short. Does Stan Lauder pay that, or does that then, or does that come from money that the contributors, and I'm not using the contributor in the term of art sense, let's call it the donor, I don't want to get FICA terms in the discussion, I'm looking more for facts. Do you end up paying that, or flip side, do you guys take a percent of the buy yourselves as part of the way to cover your costs? I'm trying to get a sense of the mechanics of the media buy.
Well, the specific vendor that we're looking to work with has quite a bit of control and accuracy over those purchases, and we're going to do the best that we can to not have those situations where we end up owing. But ultimately, if that happens, I don't see any alternative that we would have to cover that cost if additional funding does not come in for that particular ad in order to be able to cover that cost. Then I see no alternative but us covering it.
I hear you saying you'll try your best, and you know, the thing about being on the FEC is I think we get to bring to the table our past. And my guess is, and this is not in the record for this AO, but it's inevitable that this situation is going to happen because it just happens every time you do media buys. If you do any kind of volume of buy, that it could happen. So if you are sort of putting money in, you are essentially paying for something. So that makes a disclaimer. You know, you see where I'm going?
I do. And our intent is to disclose that information. Individuals can subscribe to particular ads where they get updates on how that money is spent. And we will disclose what our contribution was to that particular ad so that the internet community can keep a tab and make sure that we are doing our job to be nonpartisan.
Okay. Let's talk about the content of the ads for a minute, because I've heard a couple different things that I need to try to make a little more consistent. On the one hand, you've said you're taking ownership of the ad, but we're not sure whether it's really ownership in the sense of licensing, right? We haven't worked through that yet, because I guess you're not... In an ideal world, you'd want an exclusive license, but you don't really know if people are going to give you that, so you have to remain open, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. But what I want to talk through is more the legal side of this, because I think I have the facts and the model down pretty good. But I'm thinking about I'm coming at this from the complete opposite direction, and saying, let's say something goes wrong, right? Which is what really lawyers get paid to think about, right? Is okay. Let's say something goes bad where there's a lawsuit, and it turns out someone gave you an ad, and they claim they had copyright in the material, and let's go short of a lawsuit. Let's say it's footage from a ABC affiliate in a market, and the NBC affiliate tells you we're not going to air the ad because we know that's our footage, or we know that's their footage, and we have... Who's ultimately responsible for that sort of decision and or negotiation with the station and the decision to change the content of the ad? Do you go back to the person who produced the ad, or is that something that you do on the fly? Because if you don't do it on the fly, you're not going to get the ad on TV in a timely manner if it's a political ad.
Well, first of all, we're going to, at that stage where we move to primetime, where we open it up for funding, and we really open up our exposure to how much money is coming in, and we are committing to playing that ad, we're going to pre-clear that with the networks that we intend to broadcast that on. And so our goal is not to get into that situation, because that would obviously be problematic from a business perspective. So we're going to pre-clear that. There is still the possibility, for whatever reason, that they would then turn around and say, we're not going to play that ad, in which case, if that money is unspent, then we have the opportunity to return it to those customers, or more likely, we would really just change the direction. We reserve the right to modify our advertising strategy in that situation, and try to, if we have to do minor changes to the content, not substantive, then we have opportunities to just to make those minor changes and play that, or change our advertising strategy of where we're playing that.
What if you pre-clear it, which sometimes stations will do, sometimes they won't, and everybody thinks you're fine, but then a letter comes into the station that says, hey, you say that I voted for this legislation that did X, but it turns out that it didn't do that, and because the legislative digest was wrong. It's actually a real case. There's a defamation case years ago on that. Now you have to figure out what to do and change the content. And where I'm going with this is ultimately who's responsible, because that gets to me the issue of whose speech is it, and therefore what the disclaimer ought to be. And that who's holding the bag at the end of the day if something unforeseen happens?
Well, part of the answer is this. If that happens, whether it's a defamation issue or an IP issue, and it's out there, and whoever has the problem with it comes forward and they show the evidence that, you know, whatever the representation we got from the creator was bogus, we recognize he's going to just have to pull the ad down. We hope that in most instances that takes care of the problem. There is the possibility, of course, of a lawsuit down the road. We would expect that would name StandLouder.com, and we would have rights against the folks who provided the license representation of a license. But I think in most instances, particularly, you know, if history is true on the web, if it's a quick pull down, we hope that's going to resolve most of the problem. But that is a decision that'll be made by StandLouder.com. Mm-hmm. It's not a decision that's going to be made by the ad creator.
Let's keep going down worst case scenario. You pull the ad, but it ran for a couple days, and someone still files a strike suit because they think, oh, we see StandLouder. You know, oh, there's an incorporated here. Maybe they have an insurance policy. Maybe there's a deep pocket. Let's just file a suit and see what happens. They could sue the creators too, I guess, but you could have a mess. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is, to me, that's part of paying for an ad, and which makes the paid for by Stan Louder disclaimer all the more accurate, because part of the headache of doing an ad is assuming and thinking through potential disaster scenarios. So even though it's the creator's speech, you guys are kind of making it your speech too. Even if you're not actually paying monetary money today for it, in a way you kind of are potentially paying monetary money tomorrow. Right? I mean, I don't want you to say yes or no, because if you do get sued, God forbid, you don't want somebody to pull this transcript and say, well, you admitted all these ads are yours.
Right.
But I'm just throwing it out there for FECA purposes.
There are a whole range of issues on which the ad creator can say, I don't like what you're doing with it. I don't like where you're putting it up. Too bad. I mean, it's the decisions of StandLouder.com. That is the service that's being provided, and StandLouder is going to be very clear about that they're taking on this decision making, because we think that's what the public wants. But that's the model. He will be making those decisions.
So the person who produces the ad, it's still their ad, kind of, sort of, but not really. StandLouder is, it becomes StandLouder's ad for purposes of at least our disclaimers.
Yeah. We believe so.
Right. Like it to me.
On a creativity end, do they own something? Probably, but whose ad is that out there? We believe it's Stan Louder's.
And you may occasionally have to pay for part of placement, even though you don't anticipate it. That's already been covered. What other things may be helpful to us to decide on the disclaimer issue that paid for by Stan Louder is the correct tag that we haven't already covered? And I was fleshing out other things, you know, and other commissioners have fished for similar things. Is there anything we're missing?
I don't think so. I think we tried to lay it out as best we could in the submissions as to why it's Stan Louder. And again, we went through the analogies that are there, and it is Stan Louder just as much as it is put the name of an advocacy group there who get all sorts of support from lots of folks for all aspects of production of ads that go out there.
This is why I'm thinking Draft B does make the most sense. Draft A was put out. Sometimes you have to put out a draft that sort of exercises the brain a little bit, and it sort of exposes why that's the wrong answer. You know, until you see Draft A, it doesn't. B doesn't become. It's not as easy to see B as the right path, and as you explore the others. I think C goes a little too far, and it ignores some of the what we're all talking about here. But there still is that tension because you don't fit squarely within, you know, either. And yeah, you're a for profit, but just because you're a for profit doesn't mean that doesn't necessarily get you out from under all this stuff in these books that we have in front of us, but it could, and it's tricky. But I appreciate the answers, and it certainly helped me in my thinking. But I think B is probably, since it seems like you've your comments say B's fine with you. Is there anything in B that you feel may cause problems for you down the road, or ideas you may have that I just don't want to put you in the box unnecessarily. Any more than the disclaimers put you in the box.
Since it's what we asked for, I don't know what other.
Right, be careful what you ask for. Right.
No, I mean, we think B accurately reflected what we had submitted and the road we were going down. So
okay, thanks.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions I'd had when considering this request was how to characterize the money that you're getting from those who are making pledges. And the comments that you submitted yesterday, I believe, answer that question. On page 3, it says that the funds paid to air the communications will be StandLouder.com corporate funds, not funds that are held in escrow in the for the content creator. Now, right. Page 2, there was also language which indicates that StandLouder.com has no obligation to return donations to a funder if an ad is not run. So the monies that you're receiving from those who make pledges and then who follow through and actually convey that money to you. For one thing, I'm assuming that when they make that pledge, that you talk about transparency, that's all going to be made clear, that these monies become StandLouder.com's money. So, yes. So in a way, these aren't personal accounts that you are setting up for them that they can then return money back to them or steer it towards other ads as they see fit, unless, of course, there's not enough support. And you talked about the $1 scenario where they could redirect it if they wanted to. These monies do become StandLouder.com's.
That's absolutely correct.
So in a very real sense, if there is a disclaimer that says paid for by StandLouder.com, that's absolutely correct, because by the way that you've set up your operation, those monies become the organizations. Is that correct?
That's correct. And even in the default scenario we talked about, where if the person doesn't choose another ad to redirect their money to, it will go to a series of charities that are listed on the website. And the donors have no control over that.
Okay.
They're going to go there. The charities will be out there. They'll be listed by StandLouder.com. There's no control over saying I want it to go to 1, 3, and 5, but not the rest of them.
Okay. So in a way, you're acting like a media vendor. And again, it goes back to the issue of what box to put you in. But in a very real sense, you're not. In that, it doesn't sound like there's the model by which you're operating is not a contractual situation where either the creator or the people who are providing the money are entering into a contract with StandLouder in order to perform a service. It's more there's a fee that's paid to place it on the website, and then you recruit funding. Funding becomes StandLouder.com's, but it's not. This is not a contractual relationship of the sort that you would typically see in a vendor client situation. Is that correct?
I think that's accurate.
Okay. So
it's contractual in the sense that we're explaining what is going
right.
to be done with the funds that they have, and that'll be in the terms of service,
right.
and they must agree to it, but not contractual in the nature that you were describing.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think many of the other questions that have been asked that I had have been asked and answered, but that was the primary one that I had, was about the nature of the money that comes into the organization. I'm also leaning towards draft B as well, and again, I don't know if we'll be able to resolve that today, but I hope we can move in a direction where we can find comfort. But I acknowledge, and I think all of us have acknowledged, that this is a bit of a tricky one. And I think the further we got into the details, we realized just how this was quite unusual. And there were concerns not only about this, but making sure that we don't undo things we've done in the past, and that we don't create headaches for ourselves in the future. So hopefully. And again, thank you for coming and answering a lot of the questions that we have, because I think that's helped clarify our thinking about how to go forward. So thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you. It's good to see you again. As you can see from our drafts, we're kind of all over the map in some ways on how to deal with this, and some of it has to do with the more education on the matter. There's a couple areas that until today, I had concerns about, and maybe still do, because you say in your letter that I think they have to agree that you can modify the product in whole or in part. And when you say that, that doesn't leave much restriction on what you do with it. And while we're here today and you say that it will only be to meet technical requirements, that statement alone caused me some question as to what you really could do it if you really wanted to. And So then, you know, there are scenarios, but what I, you know, you obviously try and figure out what's enforceable, what can we do in a certain case, and what about the case that's really off the charts and everybody makes a lot of money, and then that's when everybody gets more concerned about what's in the contract. So I wondered, first of all, is a copyright held by the creator or by Stan Laudor? I gather it would be, is there a copyright formality that takes place in something that, you know, you perceive to be a winner? Or what happens?
Part of the terms of service will be the license that the creator needs to agree to, and that they're agreeing to license their intellectual property to us to use or modify as necessary. So it will be contractual. It's part of the website. Right. Pretty standard, but you kind of, you know, click on the agreement and you move on. It's the way it is these days. So that will be a part of it. But in terms of the, you know, Victor described the nature of the changes, and those really are changes of a technical nature, and that it's the business model that drives that. If people are donating funds to an ad they see on the website, and then what ends up being on TV bears no resemblance because he's modified it, then he's out of business. That's not a business model that works. So it's really on the technical end of it that the TV just may not accept the quality of the video, and he needs to be able to use it and modify.
But just go back to the copyright. And this may be not that big a deal, but who really owns the rights? If it's licensing, you're getting rights from the creator, but how do you know that the creator is even entitled to give you any? Just because it went on the website doesn't mean it didn't come from his best friend or you know, from some corporation, or what gives you the confidence that you can then go out and raise people's money and put it on the ad, kind of hang yourself out when you don't, unless there's some contractual or legal basis that you know you're getting your rights from?
Well, that will be part of the representations that need to be made in the terms of service, that people are representing that they do have the rights that they are conveying to Stan Laudor, which is fairly common when dealing with licensing. If it turns out that is wrong, we then have an action against that the person who provided it. Certainly hope that that's not the route we have to go down. It's more likely ads get pulled down. But there will be a representation, and it will be in a contractual basis on the website that the individuals who are providing the information have the right to convey it to us.
The other, we just continue on a couple other issues. When I looked at the structure of what happens, somebody gets, you send, somebody sees it on the website, says, looks good to me. They send you a grand. They see that it's getting more popular. They send you a couple more grand. And then all of a sudden it turns out that there's a problem with it and you pull it. Now, the way I understand it, it's your money. But is there any process that provides for a refund if the ad doesn't go once it gets started? Or, I mean, I see it somewhat really as trust money in a way, because you promise it's going to go to a charity, and if it's your money, it shouldn't make any difference at that point. And I'm just wondering.
There's no obligation to return that money to the individual. They can redirect it to any number of ads, but that we want to make it clear, when that money comes in, that becomes Stan Laudor corporate money. And it's there to be spent according to the guidelines that Stan Laudor has outlined.
But if for example, the ad does get pulled, what would happen? Then,
well, as a practical matter, we'd have to make a decision what's in the interest of our business and how to deal with that and satisfy the customers. And so we would take some action at that point, inform the customers of the situation, and give them perhaps the opportunity to redirect that the remaining funds that were not used to other ads, something like that. But ultimately, I don't think we're obligated to give that money back. But we're going to make the best business decision to keep our customers happy.
It's a business proposition on all ends, for the folks who are contributing money as well as for Stan Laudor.
I'm sorry, what was that?
It's a business proposition on both ends. There is a risk, some risk, for folks who are, donating their dollars.
Do you, envision in kind of phases of contributions. So if one really takes off and hits the jackpot, you can have another kind of like offering where people can continue to offer money. Or, I mean, how would it work if you decide it's 10 grand gets you out and gets you in the air and looks pretty good, and the next thing you know, you're really talking about real money, as some things happen, as we all know, and then what would you perceive to be a way to continue to raise money to
advance that? We would continue to keep that ad in the prime time category and have it open for funding, for additional funding, until such time that that funding stops. And then at some point we cut it off and we say we're going to spend the rest of our dollars that we have for that and retire that campaign and then move on and go to a different one.
And I would add from your lips to God's ears that happens.
The other thing is you have another aspect in which you're going to make money. I gather there could be caps, banners, scarves, whatever else.
Advertising.
Bumper stickers. I don't know, phrase might catch up. Where's the beef? Things like that. But when that happens, will there be any sharing by the creator at that point? Because that's when the creator starts getting thinking, well, maybe I really shouldn't have. I was talking about TV, but not, you know, other things. So what will the contract say?
There are going to be a number of different kinds of promotions that the company is going to offer. Periodically on the intake side, there will be some prizes and promotional times where there might be a winner for the ad that gathers the most money. It's also contemplating that under certain circumstances, on terms to be laid out, and applicable to all, there might be an opportunity for the ad creator to share in a small portion of the profits that come in if it's a wildly successful ad. So that they might get I won't put a dollar amount on it, but
don't bind yourself.
We right, and it's an incentive for the creative folks out there to say, you know, gee, if this really takes off, maybe I can get a little something out of it.
Sure, we want to encourage creators that are successful to come back and do it again. And if they have some financial incentive to do that, that's what we're offering to them for that in terms of a percentage of the broadcasting costs and potentially a percentage of the profit that we make off of selling merchandise that's branded with the slogan for that particular campaign or some message associated with that ad.
The way I understand it, if that were to be the case, though, it would still be completely discretionary on your part. There's no present thinking that there would be a royalty of some kind.
No, we've left the possibility that it may be offered, and when it's offered, it would be offered on terms that are equally available to all, and the circumstances and the amount would be stated on the website.
You mean to all people who donate, or to the creator?
The creators, the terms
of when,
yeah. To the creators. We'd like to get some money in the door first.
Right. I guess one of the things that occurred to me is when you have a situation where you see an ad, you can spend a lot of money on it, and you put a lot of time into it, and you're buying creative thought on how to do it and then how to place it, and the creator you're still talking to the creator and the creator's got some ideas, and all of a sudden it takes on a new form and you're all working together and you have the right to modify in whole or in part, you do become something in far over $1,000 or something, and this is a single thrust of effort. It does seem to me to have take on the indicia of a political committee. It seems to me that there might be in certain instances, and we're not talking about your other option, which I think we all agree is a potential, you can form your own IE. But I'm just thinking through, at some point, do you take that into consideration? Or?
Well, in terms of whether Stand Louder itself, leaving aside the creators and the funders, but in terms of whether Stand Louder .com becomes a political committee because of those activities. Again, trade associations and advocacy groups do that every day of the week, and that does not a political committee make.
Yeah, I heard your argument on that, but here, we'll have to see, how it gels, but it seems to me that if you have a series I could see where, and from our perspective, how it might morph into something more than a one-time ad or a one situation where the creator comes up with an idea and things gel, and the next thing you know, there's another somebody else has done the same thing, something like it, and so they want to partner up and maybe morph the two together and put it on the website again and then go from there, and the people that have contributed to A and B may want to join C. Or I mean, there must be a number of ways that you'll be thinking about to take the best of talent and make something good out of it. So that may be a number of ways that you can do it. And I've just been trying to think through how your model would work in cases like that.
But Stand Louder won't be putting all those individuals in touch with each other. That's not part of the model. We're not going to do that through the message forum, and not going to do that otherwise by calling them up and say, hey, you should probably get together with so-and-so because you're all... That's not the model at all. There won't be that nature of communications unless it's something about a license that you might need to talk to a creator about. So in terms of that, the communicative aspect, creating a political committee, that's not the model of the company.
Yeah, if we start encouraging that would make us a partisan entity on behalf of that particular message, and that's exactly what we want to stay away from.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. If you find yourself putting money into one partisan ad, how can you not put it into another? How can you really claim you're nonpartisan if you find yourself really sticking 10 grand into an ad and, you know, reporting that? People are going to say, well,
because
nonpartisan.
Because it's all done on an objective basis. We say up front how we're going to do that. So, for example, in the scenario presented earlier where we have a certain amount of pledges and we think that this ad is going to be good, and then we put our own funds in, we'll make that clear that we would do that for any ad in that situation, regardless of who it supports or what issue it supports. And then we would apply that objectively.
I just think in terms of optics, it might be hard to accomplish that when there's nothing else out there that would give you the opportunity to do it for the other side. And so you might be tainted with the view that, well, you really are heading in one direction politically and gave strong support to this ad, you know how it goes. So I was just thinking, trying to pick your brain on options.
That decision is all based upon website users donating funds. So the decision is really made by them. If it's a threshold, for example, we said, hypothetically, if the company were to say, you know, if any ad that gets to the 95% level and you need another 5% to do in an airing, the company would contribute in. That's a policy that would be available to everybody. But whether a company makes the 95% of funding is not decided by StandLouder.com. It's decided by all the website users who come there and like a particular ad and get it up to that level, regardless of the party or candidate being supported or the issue or your kid's baseball team.
One of the things that I think bothers me too is the fact that the speaker is really the creator, and the money is not Stan Louder's until, you know, it's really becomes that from somebody else's, and whether we really are meeting our obligation for disclosure by using Stan Louder as the one, if we were to pick that option, to be responsible for the ad. So I'm thinking through the, you know, A and B and C, in theory, the creator, who might be the one that's the most important in the whole thing, in addition to the work Stan Louder does, may never be disclosed in theory.
Right.
And so that's a concern to me. And what thought is given to foreign money?
Prohibited. In terms of
certainly it's prohibited. You get a check from a corporation. What will you do? Al Jazeera 2 or something like that. I don't know.
Well, you know, I mean, political committees have an obligation.
Yeah,
to
I didn't mean to point
checks.
That out necessarily, but you know, right. Something that clearly is heading one direction, an important political issue. That could be a number of things, and What's your thinking about how to deal with that?
Again, the terms of service have specific requirements, and individuals who donate funds cannot be a foreign corporation, a foreign national, a federal government contractor, a federally chartered organization. That's prohibited, and they have to make that representation up front. And, you know, that kind of representation as to the nature of the funds and the entity is a process that the commission has approved many times in many AOs.
So if there are significant violations, who's the appropriate respondent? In other words, if there's significant foreign money flowing into the particular ad, regardless of some, you know, email representation, 10 grand goes in from X corporation and X so-and-so. I mean,
I certainly would think that would be...
Who's responsible for the veracity of the representation?
In those circumstances, Commissioner Walter, where somebody has made a representation that there's somebody other than they are and they're funneling money through the system that is would be illegal, I would say it's the entity that's making the donation. But as an organization, we're going to do everything we can to vet by requiring a representation that's part of the terms of service.
And that's all I have right now. Thanks.
Well, I was just going to say go ahead.
I just have a couple of follow-up questions. On this issue of the creator of the ad and whether they're going to be disclosed or not. You said in your comment, in most instances, the ad creator will not have paid, your quotes, anything other than the cost of creating and submitting the ad. They obviously will have paid $25. We know that. That doesn't rise to any, you know, meaningful threshold. And they could conceivably, I mean, maybe they did it up on their home computer and put no resources into it, but maybe they went out and hired actors and camera people and actually put significant resources into it. And do I understand from your maybe answer to Commissioner Bowerly that if indeed they do put significant resources into it and that ad ends up on the air and is not just put on the internet, that will be captured, that contribution will be captured?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's helpful. Also, on this issue of people who put money in, and you know, you said, well, if there's extra money in the pot and there's, they won't have control over it. It'll go to one of these charities that you all are going to pick, although you disclose in advance what the choices would be. But they do have the option of picking another ad. So they sort of retain some control over their money, but not entire control. They're not going to get it back. But, you know, again, we're sort of in this half of this and half of that area. It doesn't quite fit neatly into pre-existing legal rubrics.
I think the key thing there is they don't get it back.
They don't get it back. But, you know, if they have control over it to the extent that they can say, okay, but you will spend it, you are contractually bound to spend it on this. If I tell you to put it into this other ad, they've still got control over it.
Well, we see that as part of the service that they're buying.
And I gather from your press release that this is, I mean, you've said that you think the political ads are not going to be a major part of what you do. But I gather this is all brand new. You haven't, you're just starting up now. So it's not as if you have an existing business model and you're now branching out into political advertising when you used to be doing these, you know, baseball teams and church fundraiser stuff. You're starting on a blank slate. You want to do whatever kind of ads, and that's why you're here, because you want to include political ads. But you don't actually know at this point what percentage of your business is going to come from political ads. Right?
That's accurate. We do not know for a certainty, no.
So it's possible it could be 95%.
I think that would probably change depending on the time frame, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so, you're starting up at the beginning of a presidential election year, which makes me think that maybe in your launch year you might have a substantial portion of election-related ads.
In our request, there was sort of two parts to the argument. Number one, we view ourselves as a commercial vendor and are not a political committee for that reason. Mm-hmm. The alternative was, even if you didn't find us to be a commercial vendor, it's not major purpose. We think we fall out of the political committee category under both, but clearly the latter scenario is to some extent to be determined.
Okay. I mean, it doesn't feel like a traditional political committee. It feels more like something commercial, but then the question is it more like a vendor, or like a media vendor, or is it more like, you know, the trade association or the advocacy group?
You know, I would point out that on the disclosure end of it, and we gave this a lot of thought.
I believe you.
Because we had to. it was something that was important to Victor, that this be transparent. And, you know, we stumbled to the conclusion that you end up with more effective disclosure if this is not a political committee than if it is a political committee. Because as a non-political committee, the IE and EC reports will marry up the contributors to an ad. If this is a political committee, that doesn't happen. You don't find out who supports a particular ad. You just find out that we have all these contributions that come in, and going out the door, the entity, the political committee, made a disbursement for an EC. So there's really more effective disclosure not being a political committee.
Well, still IE disclosure, isn't there?
Still an IE, but it doesn't marry up the ad to the donor. All you get is an EC or an IE disclosure that the political committee has done that.
Well, that's a larger question.
Yes, it is.
That
much
we
larger.
Don't want to bury your request in as to whether there ought to be donors listed on those IE and EC reports. But
right.
You don't want to go there.
It is a big issue. I understand.
It is a big issue, really big issue. You know, and I do. I don't want you to perceive my questions in any way to be suggestions that I think you're trying to do anything nefarious here. I appreciate that you really do appear to be interested in transparency. You do appear to be looking for ways to promote disclosure. I sincerely appreciate that. It's an innovative, intriguing idea, and we're all kind of struggling with what to do with it. Just speaking for myself, I'm just trying to figure out what's. What's the way to get to a place where we do get the best and the most appropriate disclosure and disclaimers on these ads? Not sure if I'm quite there at this moment in time, but you know, your time's not quite up yet, so we could get there for you. But I appreciate your running through all these different scenarios with me,
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther's questions raised a follow-up for me as well. Can a content creator cancel its license with you? And let me give you a scenario because I think that might be helpful. So I'm a creator. I put up an ad. You look at it. You readily recognize that there's perhaps someone else's copyright involved. You call me up and say, we can't, you know, we're going to be in trouble. You can't use this corporate, you know, image because it's copyrighted or whatever. And I say, well, but that's the crux of my ad. And I don't want you to run it without that because that's sort of from my perspective as the creator, the heart and soul of it. So can I cancel my license with you? Can I pull my ad from your site at that point?
Unless I'm legally advised otherwise, my response to that would be yes, the license would only be in place if we actually accept your ad. Because if we don't accept your ad for display on the website, then you're not getting any service for what you paid. So.
Okay, so now
I'm not sure I understand the premise. We're talking about where there's a problem with the license in the first place.
No, I'm talking, well, perhaps, but So I put my ad on your site. I pay you my fee. I've clicked all through the boxes and say I am who I am, and I'm giving you this license. So you do a pre-vet at that point before even is available to any other user,
before
it even appears on your site.
We do a minimal pre-vet to make sure that there's not any that there's obviously, you know, if there's a music from that the background music is obviously recognizable and is not
in the public domain.
Right. Then we would clearly we would send that back and ask for a resubmission with appropriate content.
Okay. And so once it's reached the original, so it goes to the initial vetting stage, it is up available for people to pledge. Let's say we're at that stage. So it's on your site.
Yep.
It didn't, because the music was, let's say, obscure, and you didn't, nobody recognized it immediately, but now you see somebody's come to you and said, you know, you can't use this. You come back to me as the creator, and I give you that answer. I say, well, you can't have it without the music because that's really important to me, so I'm going to can I revoke my license to you at that point? Or once I have given it to you,
it's probably not a license to be revoked. If they didn't have the right to it, let's say it's music that violates, we're going to pull it down, and we're not going to run that ad again. And they didn't have a right to give us in the first place.
Right.
Exactly.
So, I mean, we've got to pull that down.
Okay.
You know, if they've got Eye of the Tiger on the thing, and
sure,
hopefully we will have picked that up.
How could you miss that one?
So maybe it's more obscure, you know, but we got to pull that down.
Okay. So what if it's not what if the original license is valid? So it's not really, it's not a copyright problem, but you come back to me and you say that the TV station is telling us this ad quality is too grainy for display or whatever the technical problem might be. I'm not a technical person. But you come back to me and say, we're going to have to, you know, clean this up or make some changes. Can I say no to you?
I don't think so.
No, not during that period of time. They've given us the right to make those modifications because that's what we need to do to get it on the air.
Right.
Okay, so at that point, as I think Commissioner Gann's questions are pointing out, so part of speech is taking this legal responsibility for what happens with it, and that sort of gets back to the crux of where I'm at, and I appreciate your information today. I think it's been really helpful, and I don't want to preclude any other discussion, but I'm going to ask to hold it over to the next meeting so that we can consider some of this stuff, because If it's your speech, then it's your speech, and if it's IE's, then it's your speech. And at that point, it seems to me, as whatever efforts and whatever objective measures you're using, it might be that you wind up engaging in express advocacy on both sides of a particular race or on both sides of a particular issue, in terms of who to support because of their position on taxes or because of their position on taxes from a different perspective, and that makes you seem not like a vendor to me, but I understand that this is sort of a new model, and that's why I think this has caused so much discussion here today, and I appreciate your information.
Any other questions or comments? I, too, am able to support Draft B today, but it's been held over, which I think makes the most sense because there are at least a few commissioners that want to take some time to think about your helpful answers to all of our questions. And as I mentioned to you earlier, my understanding is that the 60-day deadline is January 23rd. Is that correct, Council?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And so we have a little over a week before the deadline, and we will get back to you. We'll either discuss it at the next open meeting or consider it at some point before January 23rd.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
for coming in. It was a very helpful discussion.
So Mr. Dealey made it through his first advisory opinion request. Thank you for stepping up to serve as the acting associate counsel for policy. Did I say it right?
General counsel.
General counsel. Oh, sorry.
Happy to serve.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Good to have you up here.
wanted to announce today something exciting. The Reports Analysis Division is unveiling a new web page, and we're going to be putting out a press release, if we haven't already, shortly after the meeting. It's a page designed to assist committees with reporting of campaign finance activity. When you get a chance to look at it, you'll see that it's very user-friendly, and I'm confident that this will be very useful to the public in this election cycle. And on behalf of all of us, we thank the RAD Division and Information Technology for their hard work in putting this together. It was clearly a major undertaking. And so, Ms. Ciccone, thank you for sharing it with us this morning. And there's a handout that you have out in the lobby. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hunter, for allowing me, and commissioners for allowing me to say a few things about the new webpage. It's located under the Help with Reporting and Compliance section of the main FEC page, and my staff and I are really excited about presenting this new resource for the filing community. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the design of it. It was designed to reflect the mission of RAD, which, for those that aren't aware of it, is to enforce the disclosure requirements by ensuring clear and accurate reporting of campaign finance activity for the public, and also to provide assistance to filers trying to comply with these disclosure requirements. The web page that we've created provides filers with an easy way to find these resources most relevant to their specific filer or committee type. And it's all in one place, so that was sort of the idea behind it, so that they didn't have to go all over our website to try to find what is actually relevant to their specific committee type. It's organized to enable filers to click on their type of committee, whether it be a candidate, a party, or a PAC, and find resources such as limits relevant to their committee, independent expenditure timeframes, that sort of thing, FEA timeframes for party committees. Also, frequently asked questions for that specific committee type, as well as reporting guidance relevant to their type. It also serves to provide more transparency of RAD, the Reports Analysis Division, of our review process. And it includes an overview of the RAD review process, as well as frequently asked questions on requests for additional information, which are also referred to as RFAIs, sent to filers regarding their disclosure reports, and other RAD processes. We hope the web page is a place filers will find answers they are looking for when preparing their reports or responding to RFAIs. We welcome any feedback on how to improve the site or ideas for additional content, and we've provided an email address on the main page of our web page for this purpose. I'd also like to highlight in the near future, I've been told this morning that the relatively near future, within the next couple weeks, that we will provide a function that will allow committees to actually look up their contact information for their specific campaign finance analyst. So they'll be able to type in their committee ID number or through a name search, and they will receive that information in terms of who's assigned to their committee for and who reviews their reports. And, you know, the website isn't designed to replace that customer service that we provide within RAD, just to supplement it. So we encourage people to still contact their analysts for any questions with filing. Finally, and most importantly, I'd like to thank my bright and talented staff members who worked on this project. It was a complete team effort. They used their expertise as well as their experience assisting filers on a daily basis on the phone, and they used all of that to design a thorough and user-friendly resource for filers. Specifically, I'd like to recognize Kendra Hannon and Rosa Lewis for their leadership on this project and their commitment to keeping it moving forward. It's been a work in progress, I'd say, for the last, year and a half to 2 years, I hate to say. But we all get busy with other things, and this sort of was pushed aside at one point, and we started it up at the beginning of last year. So thanks to them, as well as Jody Winship, Dan Buckley, Rebecca Howe, James McAllister, David Garr, Ashley Carter, and Jill Sugarman for their contributions to the content of the webpage and for working so well together as a team on this project. And also my amazing management team for overseeing the project. And there's also a couple people outside of RAD we'd like to express our appreciation to. Atik Warwick from the Office of Chief Information Officer, who built and published the site. He also trained RAD staff members on the software for the web, and happily answered countless questions from us when we were going through and creating the content of the website page. Greg Scott of our information division and his staff for all the work they put into the content of the whole FEC website on a daily basis. Their hard work and dedication to the content on the website enabled us to provide many, many resource links on our webpage. So things such as contribution limits, filing deadlines, and that sort of thing. So thank you to that group. And a special thank you to our staff director, Alec Palmer, and our compliance officer, Pat Carmona, for their unwavering support of this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ciccone, and to all the people that you recognize this morning. We appreciate your efforts. Well, now that we have the new RAD webpage, hopefully fewer people will end up in the enforcement process here at the FEC. But in case there still are some, we wanted to also announce another change that we've made very recently in the enforcement process, which is when the commission enters into pre-probable cause conciliation after a finding of reason to believe, we send a draft conciliation agreement to the respondent. And in there, we include a dollar amount to open conciliation negotiations. In the past, we haven't provided a lot of information on how the commission came up with that figure. And going forward, we made this decision in an executive session in December. Going forward, we will now set forth the basis of the calculation of that open offer for the civil penalty, and we think that's a very helpful improvement and one that we have heard about from the public for a number of years, including some comments that were filed in advance of the House administration hearing that we had on November 3rd of last year. So we're looking forward to hearing feedback from that and hope that it helps respondents and has a more productive conciliation process. Does anybody want to comment on that process, on that new change? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I think it's great. No, just a couple thoughts. The when I was first appointed to the commission, what struck me the most was how much folks who worked here assumed people who didn't work here knew about how this place operates, and there was a chasm between what people on the outside thought happened versus what really happened. And until I was here and saw all these supposedly secret books and files, I didn't realize there were. It hit me that there wasn't really a lot of stuff that really was top secret, and that there was a lot of confusion as to how things were done. One of the issues was in conciliation, people, myself included, felt occasionally you would get an out-the-door offer with a penalty that seemed out of sync with what either publicly available MER said the penalty ought to be or what you maybe had in another case or whatnot. And when you would ask the question, how'd you get the number? OGC would kind of sit there and say, well, this is the number, and they never really would say. And as a result, people on the outside would blame OGC, and they would say OGC's hiding the ball, and they're no good, and they're playing fast and loose, and they're making it up. Well, the truth is they weren't. The commission approved the number. The commission probably talked about it. And in a lot of ways, OGC was shouldering the blame that really should go to the commission. And if the commission's going to come up with a new way to do something, well, that's really for the commission to do. So I think it's important that the public knows that the out-the-door offers are approved by the commission. That's actually news to some people who even practice in this area every day. But more importantly, we don't have a bingo ball, bingo thing where we just pull numbers out. We actually come up with a number. And I think it's important that respondents know how the commission arrived at a particular number, because under the statute, the commission needs to negotiate. Now, statute doesn't really contemplate pre-probable cause conciliation, but the commission over time has essentially taken the post-probable cause conciliation in the statute and exported it pre-probable cause, which I think is wholly consistent with the statute. But it needs to, the commission needs to negotiate, and we've tried to instill that a little bit more. Hopefully it's had some success, because seemed like people were talking past each other. some on the outside have said, well, gee, we need to see all these charts and the penalty chart and all that kind of thing. And the reality is there is not really a one-size-fits-all chart. And to the extent there is, it seems like it can easily be changed depending on how you slant the case in chief. So where you stick somebody on a chart is actually how you decide the case, which I don't really prefer. It's better that the respondent know in a particular case how the commission arrived at the particular number, because the commission did actually agree. Some of these charts, some of the way we do things, not all commissioners agree. Even before I was appointed, that was the case in several kinds of cases. So this is, I think, a good step to having folks understand that we're not hiding the ball, and hopefully will help OGC in its efforts to actually negotiate a settlement that's appropriate for a particular case. It gives them more tools as well. In addition, just briefly on the RAD page, same thing there. A lot of mystery on RAD, and I think this goes a long way to debunking quite a bit of it. If you went to some of the more recent campaign schools, there was a tremendous amount of information that RAD was giving on how to deal with RAD, how to respond to RFAIs. It was available on the FEC website. You just needed to know where to look for it. It was in the materials, but not everybody seemed to know how to look. This puts everything in one place. There's nothing in here that really, if you're a student of the game and really paid attention, is news. It's just all in one place, but it is going to be news to a lot of people. For example, there's a question here, why did I get an RFAI? In the answer, it makes clear that RAD reviews reports on a per-report basis. One of the complaints people make on RAD is we get the same letter all the time. We answered this last time. Why do we have to do this again? Because it's a per-report basis. And once you realize it's a per-report basis, it makes a lot more sense that you're getting the same letter. So it actually provides the sort of information that those that have to file reports need that actually eliminates what some may have perceived as a secret RAD system. Much more transparent now. I think it's going to address many of the concerns people have raised. And I think these two things are very important. And I think it will allow the public and those who deal with the commission to have a little bit more confidence in what we're doing here, that it's not nearly so black box. So with that, thanks for recognizing me.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great job to Debbie and the team for on the RAD page. Nice picture, too. I like that.
The faceless bureaucrats are no longer faceless.
Yeah, look how they're not faceless. They all have faces, and nice ones, too. Friendly, call them. Actually, our RAD analysts are incredibly friendly. On the explanation of the penalties, well, no one at this table will remember this, but maybe Mr. Call remembers that I've been saying this for a really long time, that, you know, people want to know that they're being treated fairly. And I've long held the position that if we explain to them how their penalty relates to somebody else's penalty and why it is fair. You know, we don't make these numbers up out of thin air. There is a process that we go through, and we do try and treat similarly situated folks similarly, that is an aid in conciliation, because oftentimes the mistakes that people make are, in the vast majority of cases, they're inadvertent, and when people figure out that they've done something wrong, they're willing to step up to the plate and say, okay, fine, I hear you, we did this wrong, we didn't mean to, we're willing to do what it takes to get right with the law, and as long as they know they're being treated fairly, I think it really does promote conciliation and lets everybody move on and do a better job in the future. So I'm delighted that this is something that six commissioners actually finally agree on, and I think it's a good move for us, and hopefully it will the folks who receive these letters will find them helpful.
Do you have anything to add? Oh, sorry, Commissioner Walther, do you have? Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Herman?
The Office of General Counsel certainly agrees with the comments of the Vice Chair, Commissioner McGann. We're pleased at this new process, and I think it will go some distance in rationalizing the conciliation process, making it more transparent, and And also just should expedite the process because there should be more of an understanding on the part of respondents of the basis for the position. And we're pleased that the commission's decision supported it at the outset and look forward to implementing it.
Thank you.
Mr. Walther?
I'm kind of like Don McGann. Great. But more than that,
I
really want to hand it to Rad. I think this is a great thing. I always agree with you on just taking the initiative to do this because, you know, as we know from sitting up here, most everybody out there really wants to comply, but they just don't know quite how the heck to do it. And this I think, especially frequent asked questions for me, I would go over there and see if I get my question answered that way first. And I think it'll be wonderful way, maybe reduce some of the stress on RAD because people will get some information going in and comply in a better way, certainly a better mindset. So I think it's just great. Like here, we've been fighting the issue, and I think I never really litigated the FEC stuff. But in talking to Don, of course, early on when he was chair, he pointed out and made me more appreciative of the fact that when I take a look at it, what's a lawyer going to do when they're faced with a number? And the client doesn't know where the number comes from. The lawyer can't really tell them where the number comes from. The client is less likely to accept it. The lawyer can't talk him into it because he really doesn't have a basis to do it. Here, there's some groundwork previously laid where people can talk. You can talk with your client and figure out where you want to go. Is this a range that I can live with? Or do we want to go for something less? Or that kind of thing. I think it'll really facilitate a conciliation in many cases and maybe also for us give us a more level ground to work on when we try and decide what to go out the door with.
Thank you. All righty. I think that concludes. Mr. Palmer, are there any management or administrative matters to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are none.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.